I'm Mark Steiner, host of Soundbites on Delmarva, right here on Delmarva Public Radio. We spent 2 days with Purdue Vice President in both Maryland and Delaware and visited with two of the farmers who raise chickens for Purdue. We hope to be visiting with them many times in the coming months. During the next hour, you'll hear the first program in a series of conversations with Purdue as part of our series, Soundbites on Delmarva. The poultry industry is the cornerstone of Delmarva's economy, with about 14,000 people directly employed and another 100,000 or so indirectly employed by the poultry industry. Approximately 600 million birds are raised for meat annually here on the shore. The Delmarva poultry industry is in the spotlight due to a still-pending lawsuit accusing Purdue and the Hudsons, who raise chickens for Purdue on their farm in Berlin, Maryland, of being jointly responsible for causing water pollution through runoff from the Hudson farm. We sat down with members of Purdue's management team to discuss the lawsuit, environmental issues, and more. And here's part of my conversation with Steve Schwalb, Vice President of Environmental Sustainability, Dr. Bruce Stewart Brown, Senior Vice President of Food Safety and Quality, Mike Levengood, Vice President of Live Production, and Julie DeYoung, a Purdue spokesperson. I asked them who's responsible for pollution from one of their contractors' farms, such as the Hudson's.
We contract with independent family farms, and what goes on their farm is their responsibility. We provide, you know, services and support to them relating to the poultry aspect of their operation. Purdue is the only company offering things like Purdue AgriRecycle and the Clean Waters Environmental Initiative. I think we are the company that is doing the most to help farmers, you know, be responsible for the poultry litter that is a byproduct, you know, of their operation. So, you know, I think it's the lawyers will have to figure out, I guess, where the legal liability lies. But, you know, it is their farm, and they operate it, and we provide support to them as it relates to the specific contract for raising chickens.
And again, just to add to that, it is their farm, and so, like many farmers, they have more than chickens. Alan has, what, 45 head of cattle? So, you know, I mean, our responsibility is in that production area for those chickens, and as Bruce says and Mike said, for the health, welfare, and environmental piece of how we can help the grower with those chickens. But how they run their business, they're independent folks. And so, you know, they have other things. They have cows. Someone may have pigs. They got sheep. You know, that's their business. They have vegetables, what they fertilize with. That's their business. And how they manage a nutrient management plan on their crops is their business. But that poultry lid is inside that house, and those birds are inside that house, and that's what we try to help them understand how best to manage.
The Save Our Family Farm website, is it a Purdue site?
Purdue underwrote development of the site to facilitate fundraising for the Hudson's Legal Defense Fund. So, yeah, we've been very upfront about our support for SafeFarmFamilies.org. Our logo's on the homepage. We were in the headline of the news release that announced the creation of SafeFarmFamilies.org. So I think we've been very transparent about that. You know, and the fundraising activities for the Hudson started, you know, gosh, over a year ago with the Wicomico County Young Farmers and Ranchers. And as, you know, the Hudson's legal bills continued to mount and pressure, you know, I think began to grow for them to settle for financial reasons, it became evident that they needed more support. So Purdue did step in, and along with Maryland Farm Bureau, to help raise awareness of the situations for the Hudsons and to help facilitate fundraising for the Legal Defense Fund.
Why didn't Purdue just pay the legal bills?
They're an independent family farm. They have separate legal counsel, and you know it's appropriate for them to, I think, pay for their own counsel to maintain that independence. So certainly, you know, I would say that we are probably shouldering the burden of that, of the legal defense. We're co-defendants. We are actively involved, you know, in the lawsuit. And I think to the extent possible, our legal team is probably, you know, taking a little bit more of the burden than theirs to help support them. But they need to have their own counsel. And to control that, they need to pay for it. So it just seems appropriate for us not to do that for them.
Folks last night were, some people arguing that the the site itself, I meant to bring the sheet in so I could ask you the questions, is full of misinformation. I think the one thing was about the Ocean City biosolids and the MDE saying there's no way that that amount of nutrients could have come from that. It had to come from something else, and that made it look as if they were saying that that these were just biosolids and that was the whole problem.
You know, the facts remain that the Waterkeepers Alliance announced their intent to sue without ever talking to the Hudsons. They sued over a pile they thought was poultry litter that was subsequently found to be biosolids. The situation was resolved with MDE, yet the lawsuit continues. I think that's all pretty accurate and factual. And hence the Hudsons in the situation of over $200,000 in legal bills so far with the meter still running. And in a position where they're going to potentially lose their fourth generation family farm, a farm that I think has been characterized as a factory farm. And if a 2-chicken house, 45 cow, 200 acre farm is a factory farm, then there's a lot of farms in the U.S. that are at risk for this type of lawsuit.
The argument then is that when they filed what they filed, that both Purdue and the Hudsons had 72 days to respond and talk to them and have a discussion, but nobody did. And that's why the lawsuit went forward, that they did have ample time to sit and talk, but chose not to.
Again, the lawyers probably need to speak to this, but my understanding is that because MDE had addressed the situation, it was taken care of, I think they thought it was taken care of.
There was nothing to talk about.
There was nothing to talk about.
Wasn't poultry litter, and MDE told the Hudsons what to do with it. They did that, and that was it. So, I think it happened because the Waterkeepers thought it was poultry litter. And really, unfortunately, if someone had just gone to the Hudsons, truly if they cared about the bay and there's a potential for pollution from a pile that they thought was litter, all they really had to do was what Kristen Hudson says, come and bang on our door and say, what is that? Are you sure you want to have that there? Look where it is. And this could have been resolved. But, they didn't, and so it makes you wonder.
The folks at Food and Water Watch and others say, mm-hmm. The other attorneys, said that they did give Purdue notice that Purdue did not respond at all. They're saying that there was a 60-day notice letter and never heard from Purdue at all, which is why the lawsuit went ahead, there was never even a response. So if there's no response, that's why the lawsuit took place, and they, from both the Hudson side and Purdue side.
What I can tell you is our understanding that Maryland Department of Environment was addressing the complaint, and it was resolved to the satisfaction of the Department of Environment. So I think the assumption was that it had been responded to and addressed. Now, as to whether there was an official response back to the Waterkeepers on their notice of intent to sue, I'd have to go back to the attorneys on that as to, you know, if there was or was not and why they didn't. But, I mean, I think it was in all the papers and it was seen very public, that the Department of Environment was looking into it and doing testing and made their resolution. So my understanding was that they felt they were certainly aware of that and that they knew the situation had been resolved. But, you know, as to if they're saying that there was no official response, I'd have to ask the attorneys about that.
The outcome of the Waterkeepers lawsuit against the Hudsons and Purdue remains to be seen. But water pollution continues to be a problem throughout the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We know pollution comes from many sources, not just agriculture. But with so many chickens concentrated in one area here, pollution is an issue that Purdue and other poultry companies will have to grapple with. I raised the issue of pollution from chicken litter with our guest from Purdue.
Yeah, I think that's one of the misconceptions of you know, and I like to keep referring back because I don't think we're trying to understand how far we've come, how much better things are today than they used to be. Years ago, you would ride around and all times of the year, you would see piles of litter everywhere whenever houses were cleaned out. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? There was no manure sheds back then. So manure sheds, you know, the states did a great job saying, you know, we need these manure sheds. When you do the cakeouts, when you do that, have a place to store it.
I think what that is. space.
Yeah, and what it is, it's a building, and we'll probably be able to show you one today.
Yeah, we got to them.
Yeah, there's a building on the farm with a clay floor that's all designed environmentally by NRCS. You know, that this is, and they're sized for the house. We have five flocks a year. Generally, our program is we only clean the house out every 2 years. Some companies don't have a clean-out program where they put new bedding in. You just take this dry litter out of the house when you need to. So in the old days, there was people would clean out whenever, you know, whenever that suited them to clean out. Well, they would pile it in a field. They would pile it here. Now with the nutrient management plan, everything's planned. They make the decision. They go, we say we want you to clean out every 2 years, and they come back and they go, Mike, we're going to clean out in 18 months. I don't care. You know, why are you going to clean out in 18 months is because it matches my, they'll tell me then that it matches my nutrient management plan and I can put it on these fields. Or they're going to go, we're going to cake out, and they're putting it in their manure shed until they can follow their nutrient management plan. So you ride around the shore today, you don't see piles that are in fields for months. And there's rules now that after 30 days or 7 days, it has to be applied. So they're managing it all the way back into their house versus years ago, they cleaned out whenever they just would clean out. You know, we cleaned out more often years ago. Houses are drier today than they were 25 years ago. Why? Different watering systems. We used to have open drinkers in the house. Also, it was a whole different environment for the birds. Now you'll see the drinkers today that are more, we call them nipple drinkers. They're just a pin that hangs down. They trigger the pin and they drink. Less water on the floor. Houses stay drier. Accumulate less litter. Don't need to clean out the house as often. So all that's how much we've improved. You know, houses are closed. You don't smell the houses like you used to. And you know why I don't smell them? It's because they're not as wet. So because the ventilation is better. So all this technology improvement is making the conditions for the birds is probably the general reason we did the majority of it, because the conditions of the birds are much better today. They live better. They have less disease today. And a producer can take care of more birds.
And if they can, based on the nutrient management plan, if they can use that litter, if they only have the land, they just have the houses, we have par. We offer them an opportunity, Purdue Agri Recycle, to say, if you don't want to leave it in your manure shed, or you don't have that, you say, I don't have land, I don't have farmland to put it on at a certain time of year when I'm supposed to, we offer them the Purdue Agri Recycle and say, hey, we'll come get it. So it doesn't go out the back of the house. I mean, there's this misconception about where it goes. It's planned and it's managed and it's part of a nutrient management plan.
And our growers are required to have nutrient plant plans, or we don't contract with them. It's part of the requirements.
That's also state.
Yes, state requires it.
So there's again, it's that misconception of where it goes.
The flock moves out. The house is caked out and goes to the manure shed, which you'll see is very close. They truck it over and put it in the manure shed. Then it's covered up. Then it moves to the field based on their nutrient management plan. Now, they could clean it out and follow the plan of 7 days, piling in the field that they're going to spread it, because they can't spread it that day, but within in the regulation time, they'll spread it. But that's the only movement time. That's the movement time.
And it has to be located. If they do pile in their fields, there's requirements as to where that's located. So it doesn't run off, because there are some, you have a 7 days in Maryland to leave it in piled up, but it can't, has to be away from certain things. I mean, there's designated areas where you can pile. Or to Mike's point, it goes in the shed.
Until an appropriate time.
Until an appropriate time. Until they take it out, put it on their spreader, and spread it according to their plan. So, mm-hmm.
Does that help?
Yeah, no. That's why I'm asking questions. Just trying to, you know. This is my first foray to really sit down with you all. So I'm just, you know. Yeah. I hope it won't be the last. I mean, there's a lot to learn in this process. But if all that was true, then how would the MDE find the levels of pollution coming off a number of farms? One of them was that, I mean, I keep talking about Allen's farm just because that was the one in the lawsuit, but they find these levels, MDE says, you know, we find them all the time on lots of farms. So if they were being managed and just went from the house right to the shed, clearly something's amiss, because those things are going into the water.
So I can't respond to details of what MDE is finding, but keep in mind that there is a lot of sources of nutrients. You have other animals, you have wild animals, you got geese, got tons of snow geese here. There's tremendous amount of sources of nutrients. This is an agricultural area, it's a rural area. So to make the assumption that what that is because there's a poultry house, that's a heck of a leap for us. That's a heck of a leap, number one. And then number two, I think the concern that that because the a nutrient level may be high, and I mean, who knows what that is, it may or may not be related to poultry. Why are we assuming it's poultry? Why are we assuming that it's not?
If it's a farm that grows hundreds of thousands of chickens, and then the waterways by the house and the ditches are full of the nutrients, that's why the assumption is they're coming from the chickens, right?
The nutrients are in the house. The litter is in the house. And when it comes out of the house, it goes to a specific spot that is either covered or a specific spot in the field, if that happens for 7 days, or it goes to Purdue Ag Recycle. So, and that's all according to a state nutrient management plan. So, again, the assumption is, I'm not sure how they make the... Now, here's something we have to just keep in mind. I think it's a very important point. You know, Mike used the point about 20 years ago. When you and I are probably close to the same age. You're probably younger than I am, but...
Who knows? We'll find out later. When take cars out in the sea.
When you and I started driving, you know, what was coming out of the tailpipe of our car? Okay, so today, of course, not allowed. Listen, this has been an agricultural area for a lot of years. And so, who knows what was on those fields for all that time? Who knows what was there? All I know is today, and not just today, but really for the past 15 years, 20 years, 1999 was when the nutrient management planning started to happen in seriousness. We just don't dump it. It just doesn't get dumped. The farmer doesn't dump gold fertilizer in a stream, but he doesn't do it.
I mean, I also live in a rural area, so I see it all the time. I live in the middle of cornfields and soybean fields, and those farmers and my neighbors all have to have their plans done and cover crops on and all the rest. But the way our system works now, some people would argue, if you look at how we're kind of based around corn and large farming operations, is that when you do dump that nutrients on, especially in the winter, they just come... This is go flowing right off the fields into whatever waterway is there and into whatever wherever that ends up. So it might not be directly coming from, people would argue, directly from the chicken, but it's coming from what spread that came out of the chickens, right? And that is what's going into our waterways.
Well, first of all, it doesn't have to be chicken fertilizer. It could be chemical fertilizer.
Yeah, that's kind of fertilizer.
So, but we don't disagree. I don't think anybody in ag would disagree that you know, you need to apply nutrients based on what crops are. That's what a nutrient management plan is for. And based on what the soil is requiring based on that nutrient management plan. I don't think there's anyone in ag that would disagree with that. And years ago, those plans may not have been as accurate, just like, you know, what came out of our tailpipe wasn't as good years ago as they are today. So I would just tell you that because fertilizer is such a big cost of a farmer's, a big cost item to them, a row crop farmer is not going to waste that fertilizer. And so they're not going to over-apply.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, none of us are soil scientists here, you know, and none of us are water quality experts to be able to speak to what, you know, MDE may be finding. I think what we're trying to say that, you know, that if farmers are following the nutrient management plans, if it's being applied to the ground at the appropriate time of year, you know, that's the appropriate way to manage the issue. You know, I don't think anybody would disagree that if there are people that are not doing that, if someone's applying at the wrong time of year so it runs off, as perhaps you've observed, that's a different story. And that should be addressed through appropriate, I think, you know, enforcement. That's not our role to play, you know, but I think we're, you know, trying to convey what we think people are doing. You know, is everybody doing that? I don't know.
Steve Schwalb, Vice President of Environmental Sustainability at Purdue, mentioned Purdue's fertilizer recycling program. And here's Steve talking about that program.
So Purdue Ag and Recycle, first and still to our knowledge, the only, definitely the largest, commercial fertilizer recycling plant that we know of.
Poultry litter recycling plant that we know of.
So we take poultry litter. What litter do we take? Well, poultry litter, as I said, has a lot of uses. If a grower has land, they'll typically use that poultry litter themselves on their own farmland. Mm-hmm. According to their nutrient management plan, the nutrient management plan says, here's what you can use in fertilizer based on here's what you grow. And they know what the nutrient content of poultry litter is. The advantage of poultry litter is the fact that it's organic and it has a lot of organic material in it. And so it is proven to be better as fertilizer on farmland than commercial fertilizer is. And that's based on a nutrient management plan. So assuming you need the 3-2-3, the nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium content that poultry litter has, it's better than you going in for chemical 3-2-3. It does a better job on staying in the land, and it also does a better job building up the soil. So it's theirs to use. It's a valuable resource. If they don't need it, if they don't have land, why wouldn't they have land? Development today has taken a lot of land, especially here on the shore. So there are some farmers who say, I don't have the land. I want to grow chickens. And Mike can get into all the reasons why they want to grow chickens, but they don't have the land. And so where else can they go with it? Well, they can sell it to another farmer, which many of them will do, because another farmer might have the land. Or if they can't use it, we'll buy it and we'll take it to Purdue Ag and Recycle. And there we convert it into organic poultry fertilizer. OMRI certified, that's the Organic Materials Research Institute, certified organic fertilizer, which all the organic farmers are using. So, and the neat thing about it is it becomes in pellet form. We put it into pellet form. We pasteurize it. So it's easy to transport. And 50% of that leaves the shore. So that means that that litter is not used on land application here in the shore at all. It's moved out of the Chesapeake Bay watershed. So that's Purdue Ag and Recycle. Go on.
When he says we buy the litter from them, actually it's an exchange. We will come in, clean out their poultry house in exchange for the litter. And then, as you know, as Steve said, then 50% of that. So we're actually moving nutrients out of the watershed.
Right. Growers are very thankful for the fact that we give them that option. The other thing, the other key takeaway is it's not only Purdue growers. We'll take it from any grower on the shore.
So if you take their litter, then those other companies don't do what you do. They do use arsenic in different parts of their operations. So do you test those pellets for the arsenic that may be coming from their farms?
That'd be a question for the guys at Ag Recycle.
Yeah, I couldn't answer that.
Okay, all right. And we were talking about pellets. And so the one thing that popped this, I reread the interview, was what percentage of the litter itself coming off, I guess, of your farms, do you actually pelletize?
It's about, okay, I'm going to get this right. We handle about 10% of the litter from the farms that raise birds for Purdue.
That sounds
right.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So, yeah, and the rest 10%. Of it then stays on the farm?
The rest the producer either uses in their own farming operation or maybe barters or sells to other farmers who apply, we assume apply it on cropland. So Purdue either recycles it into organic fertilizer or relocates it to farms that can use it, or some goes to Pennsylvania to the mushroom industry. So they both produce fertilizer and in essence, relocate it to areas that can use the nutrients.
And they're sold, just publishers are sold here or all over the country or all over the world? I mean, where are the pellets sold?
Half of what Purdue AgriRecycle produces is sold outside of the watershed. So those nutrients are literally leaving the watershed, and they go to a variety of sources. We have a distributor that sells to golf courses and parks and municipalities that are looking for organic natural fertilizer sources. It goes to organic farmers. It is certified organic, so sort of organic tomato producers in Florida, for instance, use it. It also goes to some commercial fertilizer companies who blend it into organic fertilizer products that you might buy at a Home Depot or Lowe's.
Wow. And so, now, you may disagree with this report. there was a report that came out from the Center for Livable Future, from Keith Nachman, that said that pellets have as much as 30 parts per million of arsenic. Now, so the question for somebody who hears that would be, how could that be organic?
Arsenic is a naturally occurring element. So certain soil types have, you know, it varies across the country. You know, there are allowable levels in water. So I have no idea how this 30 parts per million compares to anything. So, yeah, that's outside of our expertise to comment on today.
That's fair.
I'm your host, Mark Steiner. And you're listening to Soundbites on Delmarva. Today we're speaking with four members of Purdue's management: Steve Schwalb, Vice President of Environmental Sustainability; Dr. Bruce Stewart Brown, Senior Vice President of Food Safety and Quality; Mike Levengood, Vice President of Live Production; and Julie DeYoung, a Purdue spokesperson. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more after this short break. Welcome back to Soundbites on Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Here today with representatives from Purdue. I'm joined by Stephen Schwalb, Vice President of Environmental Sustainability; Dr. Bruce Stewart Brown, Senior Vice President of Food Safety and Quality; Mike Levengood, Vice President of Live Production; and Julie DeYoung, a Purdue spokesperson. Maryland's General Assembly will once again consider a statewide ban on the use of arsenic in chicken feed this year. Arsenic is an additive in the drug roxazone, used by some poultry growers to reduce bacteria in birds' stomachs, which helps prevent sickness and promotes faster growth. However, Purdue stopped using roxazone in 2007, and I asked them why they stopped using it and how has it been different to raise birds without the use of arsenic.
We had to learn some different things. Several things about that particular product. There was a building amount of research on different sides of the use of it as it relates to all the different issues from that. And we were keeping up with that. And we got a lot of people, spent a lot of time, thinking about the right thing to do as it relates to all the feed ingredients that we use. And we were getting quite a few questions from our consumers, asking questions about it, and as we kind of interacted with them, it became a really hard thing to explain to them why you would use that in feed, and with some of the kind of different pieces of information that were coming out, it became very cloudy for them. We also were working on a lot of different things as it relates to raising poultry and feeding poultry. That we wanted feed. We wanted to be proud of our feed. We wanted to be able to talk about our feed to people and have them trust that we're doing the right thing with it. So all those things, we were working on how management procedures with the growers to maintain good gut integrity and intestinal health and all the aspects of the fact that that product in our case was not necessary for us to do what we needed to do, so we felt good about pulling it out.
So if I mean, what was the difference? I mean, what difference did you find when you stopped using it? I mean, in terms of whether it's the meat that came out of the chicken or the chicken itself growing. And what was the difference essentially when you stopped using?
Yeah, we had worked very hard to make sure that there was going to be no downside to pulling it out, and actually when you looked at it, became kind of cost neutral from all the aspects of measuring it. Now the meat itself, if you look at all the data on meat, if you use the drug properly, you won't find elevated levels in the meat. So anyhow, I don't think there was any appreciable issue with that. We just felt like we could manage the birds without it just as well or better.
One of the things I read, some FDA reports on things that I've been looking at, and they approved this histostat, and I'm looking at my chart because I want to make sure I have the names right, nitrosone, which contain arsenic, and it's on the market. So does Purdue use those in your feed?
Those are not in our chickens at all, no.
They're not in the chickens?
No.
And so I guess it kind of begs the question why Purdue isn't part of leading the charge to ban arsenic in the state. I mean, if you decided not to use it, why not say it shouldn't be here? I mean, because we know that arsenic is a carcinogen, so why not say no?
So here's the deal. Here's our perspective. We believe that FDA is the appropriate group to judge safety and appropriateness of drugs. We don't believe as a company, I don't believe as a professional, that a state should decide on a drug unless they have the infrastructure to do all the appropriate work associated with the drug. So here, if you question the safety of a particular drug, I would think the best opportunity is to go to FDA and say, look, could you show me, I'd like to see the safety profile of this drug, and if I choose to kind of criticize the safety profile and the safety work that was done, in what way do you criticize it, and let's get that fixed. So we're trusting as a country and believe that the best way to work with medications and different feed ingredients is to have FDA be in charge of their efficacy and their safety and all the aspects of them. If you question it, let's get that in front of FDA and have them redo the safety profile if that's what needs to be done. But each state taking deciding to question the safety, well, they must add a whole bunch of infrastructure associated with all the science associated with that. I doubt that they want to do that.
I mean, from a practical perspective, even if we just look here, we're operating in three states, Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, and farmers that are growing chickens in one state may be processed in another state, and think of the management of having to have a different requirement in each of those states. How could you run a business?
You're going to have drug approvals by state. Wow, I don't think that's the. I don't think that that doesn't make sense to me.
So, when people look at, and I understand what you're saying. But when people look at this drug and they know that some of these things are carcinogenic, all the studies seem to show that it is carcinogenic.
So, Mark, then I guess you would have to pull up FDA's safety profile. This is really where the criticism, I think, falls apart, because you'd say, if you see these studies, you say, how about FDA, could you show me the safety profile you have on this? And let me make a very specific comment about this aspect of its safety. And then we'll have a good conversation. That would be useful, I would think,
And I guess dose makes the poison. You say it's carcinogenic, and Bruce is going to be well more versed to talk about inorganic versus organic and all of that. But, I think to say that something is carcinogenic is so broad as to really not even be meaningful. I mean, you have to talk about its use and application, and I think anything is carcinogenic in extreme measure. So, and to Bruce's point, FDA is best able to, I think, evaluate that.
The most productive discussion would be one with the safety documentation in front of you, and if it's a level of this that is of concern, and that's the debatable part, that would be a productive conversation to have with FDA and the appropriate scientists. You know,
what I was looking at was the EPA considering this and roxazone a class A carcinogen. I mean, they classify it as that. There was a report that came out in January that it won't be official for a while. It was 17 times more potent as a carcinogen than they thought before. Now, it's got to go through a bunch of reviews more before that comes out as an official report, but that's what they're saying. And now they're working on these kind of risk assessments of non-cancer effects of things like arsenic and ammonia and like that. Some of those are
So hopefully they would get all that in front of FDA. And say, look, we have additional information that we didn't have before. If that's true, I don't know if it's true, whatever. But the appropriate place to get that kind of, I think everybody wants the rule to be right on all the different, on all the different additives and everything that FDA approves. FDA wants to have it right. I'm confident of that. So if there's information that needs to be presented to them and for them to review the safety component to it, I believe that sounds productive to me, you know.
Antibiotics and Purdue chickens. I mean, I know that 80% of all the antibiotics we use are used on healthy animals across the country. Well, how about in Purdue's operations?
Yeah, the number that you use is,
it's too high.
Yeah, I do. But, okay, so anyhow, here's Purdue is significantly different than most poultry. We don't use antibiotics for growth promotion, haven't for a long time. We might use antibiotics to treat a sick flock. And that's a relatively small number of flocks. For instance, one of the things to help people understand the kind of level of health on our farms is if a farm might grow chickens for us, and it might have five flocks a year, and it might go 5 years before it had a flock that for whatever reason required some treatment. If it required a treatment, it would be treated for the welfare of the chickens and the appropriateness of the animals, and it might be as short as 2 or 3 days of treatment at some point in its life, which, by the way, would be done in such a way that it would never have found in any of the meat, or there's an appropriate amount of way to use a drug that makes it safe and helps the animal. So relatively super low treatment levels. The other antibiotic that is used in the feed for coccidiosis is called an ionophore. Mm-hmm. And it technically is an antibiotic, but it's not used in humans. It's not appropriate for humans. It doesn't have, it's not a significance to the human population as it relates to resistance or any of those aspects. So there are antibiotic, the term, I've started to really kind of, most people when you talk about antibiotics, they think of what they might get when they went to the doctor themselves or what they went to the doctor with their child to get a prescription for. Well, antibiotics is this big world of anything basically that has an antimicrobial activity, both fungal and bacteria of any sort. So this class of technically antibiotics of ionophores, we do use those to control coccidiosis. And again, if you talk to AMA or most knowledgeable kind of health, human health experts, this criteria of ionophores is not a significant discussion as it relates to the concern on antibiotics. Antibiotics for growth promotion? Yeah, That's a concern from their from many people's perspective.
But other poultry operations, other CAFO companies like Tyson and others do use it, don't they?
Yeah, you should best ask them.
We will.
Yeah.
I
believe you'll. You know, I have a pretty good sense of what other people do, and we are different in that, you know, aspect.
That's interesting because when I was looking at some other documents about people who do the chicken catching, is that they get a lot of infections with antibiotic resistant bacteria. But you're saying that doesn't happen in Purdue, that's not an issue for this company.
Well, Mark, the discussion of resistant bacteria is a really, really deep one. We can say with confidence and a certain amount of pride that we don't use antibiotics for growth promotion. There is a discussion of resistance that we study all the time, and I believe that if you looked at the whole body of work on resistant bacteria, the majority of the resistant bacteria is coming from the human health piece. Now, having said that, that doesn't make me feel any less responsible for our use of drugs and the appropriateness of the drugs we use. So, veterinarians in our company are required all the drugs that we might use, all the antibiotics we might use, must be prescribed by a veterinarian. We're holding them accountable to the use and the efficacy and the management of that particular antibiotic. We have a list of antibiotics we choose not to use because they're too important for humans. And there is antibiotics for growth promotion. We're not using those either. So we have a lot of rules. And it's all aimed at being responsible. That's what it's about.
Doing what we're responsible
to the bugs and the whole world of animals, and responsible to these animals.
So that I know we covered this a little bit before in the last one, but we only touched on some of these things. When we talk about the feed that Purdue uses, how much of it is from here, and how much is it brought in from outside the Bay Area or the watershed that we use?
On the shore, I'd say there's enough. What we see is there's enough corn grown on the shore. What we run into is it all comes at one time at harvest.
Right.
So we store a lot of it, but we do have to bring corn in by barge. We bring it in because you're going to feed the chickens over 12 months, and you've gotten all your corn is pretty much harvested in 2 months. So you can't store every bit of it. I'd say the shore's stressed the most if we're in a drought situation. So if it's a normal year, it's minimal that we're bringing in. But if it's a drought year, you're going to bring more in.
But you don't have any control over what's in the corn or the feed that comes from other places that you...
No,
right?
So when you say feed, we need to be a little more... We import corn. We may import soybeans. We may import different ingredients. But all the feed is manufactured on the shore.
And when you say import, you mean... from with elsewhere in the U.S.
Yeah,
other
all
regions.
Of our stuff
from the Midwest primarily.
Yeah, brought in from other areas of the U.S.
So back to the feed.
You.
No, go ahead.
But the feed is manufactured in our local feed mills. We have our own analytical lab. All ingredients are tested. All the suppliers that feed us those ingredients, they submit analysis of that feed, and we have two nutritionists on staff, and they manage the analytical lab, and we test all that. It's just like Bruce said. We're proud of the feed that we feed the birds, and it's very, very expensive. So we want it to be right. We want to make sure if we're going to spend that much money, it's pure ingredients that we're going to give these birds because it does turn into meat.
And it's, the feed's about two-thirds of the cost of growing a chicken?
Yeah. When, it's over 70% of the cost. My cost is 70% of my bill, my budget is just feed cost, close to 75% now.
Wow.
Actually, and you take feed cost and producer pay is over 80%, 85% of my total bill, my total cost.
So when Purdue stepped up and said we're not using arsenic anymore and its use, what replaced it? I mean, did you find you had to find something they had to use to replace that regimen? Did it really not affect the flocks or your production or the chicken itself?
A little bit. I mean, my understanding is that we made a concerted effort to make changes in the housing environment and the management of those flocks to enable us to move away from that. Is that accurate, Bruce? And can you talk to that?
We've worked with folks on housing and we've also got our own breed. So we
talked about that last time.
Yeah, we've worked very hard with the breed to have it be a healthy, hardy kind of bird in the absence of the things we don't want to use. So we, when we're working on, the evolution of the breed, we go, look, this breed has to kind of do well without this stuff. And we did that. I've been here 14 years. We started doing that. I mean, everybody was focused on that well before me, but we said it out loud real early in the thing. Look, here's the deal. We have to continue to evolve the health of this breed and how we raise them. And Mike's group is going to work on working with growers on how to best raise our chickens to make them have them be healthy, work on all those aspects of housing with the growers, how our practices associated with that, the feed, what can we do to make the feed better? What can we do to make the bird, help the bird be better? All those things kind of take time, but over time, you get something. You get something out of that, you know. So birds are not all the same, and certainly how you raise them is not all the same. So we have been tremendously successful with that approach. But it takes a little bit of all that, you know.
Did you want to add something?
Well, I'm just saying for our side, you know, on the housing side, the lot, you know, out with working with the producers, you had to look at the housing. And you had to say, and the best thing we do a lot of times with producers, because we're out there trying to get, it's their houses and it's their management. They're there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So all we can do is we can show up and we go, here's the kind of ways you need to, would help you manage better, to help you make more money and raise a better flock. They still have to implement all that stuff. I mean, they have to do it. When the alarm goes off in the middle of the night, they've got to get up. It's their flock and do that. So it's, so you use analogies all the time. So it's like today, people get on airplanes. And you always think about getting on airplanes and what happens. Am I going to end up with a cold in the middle of the wintertime because I got on an airplane, and I'm in the plane and, there's one person sick and it gets in the ventilation system. So you're praying that they change the filters in the planes, right? I mean, it's that kind of – so that's the housing environment we work on. We put tunnel ventilation in. We go out and we talk to the producers about, are you running enough time? Are you making sure that you're keeping enough fresh air to the birds? Guess what? If they're doing a good job with ventilation, they're doing a good job managing the environment, guess who doesn't get sick? No different than a plane.
The nutrient management system, the nutrient management plans that each farmer has, which I didn't know was, until kind of going back to it, is those like secret documents. Nobody can see them. Does that make sense? Why is that? Why is it that they're like held tighter than, it feels like they're tighter than an FBI file,
I think that's an exaggeration.
It may be an exaggeration,
Farm Bureau or one of the farmer organizations would be best to talk to that, but my understanding is that the plans they contain information about that business. It's a business. So this is information that apparently farmers feel is something that it would be proprietary, you know, to their business, and that they feel shouldn't be shared. So you'd probably need to talk to Farm Bureau or somebody more from that farmer perspective.
Talk to Farm Bureau about that. Yeah. I mean, that was part of that. The regulations about it are tighter in Maryland than they seem to be than they are in almost any other state around us.
Yeah, I couldn't speak to that.
Okay, we'll leave that for the Farm Bureau.
Sorry. But I would like to come back to one thing and shifting a little bit is I know there was some, into your question about not necessarily knowing what's in the house or whatever, and mm-hmm. just to correct something that I had heard mentioned in some other conversations, the feed formulation we have is proprietary. I think we, you know, consider it a trade secret, the exact composition of the feed. However, the main ingredients that are in there is listed on a feed tag that is delivered to the grower every time feed is delivered to the farm. So any grower who wants to know if there's, you know, additives in the feed that's been delivered to their farm, all they have to do is look at the feed tag, and if they have a question about what's in there, talk to their flock supervisor, and if they can't answer it, they'll refer them up to the nutritionists or whoever. So there have been suggestions that the farmers have no way of knowing what's in the feed, and that's simply not true.
Our feed mills are FDA. FDA monitors our feed mills, and we get audits all the time on FDA. And one of the requirements is you have to list those ingredients on a feed ticket when we deliver it to the farm. So all the feed ingredients are listed. It's the percentages of what we're using to make up our formula. So our actual formula is not on there. So it's no different than looking at a can of soup. You see what all the ingredients is. But it doesn't give away the recipe, does it? So it's no different. It's the same. So our feed ticket shows what's in a can of soup.
So you're saying that everything on the feed ticket, that there's nothing else in the feed that's not on the feed ticket?
Can't be. I mean, FDA. It's FDA regulated. We're regulated. It's the ingredients that we use also have to be approved through FDA. And all. We're not going to buy ingredients from somebody that's not approved. So they have to go get all their approvals before they could even sell ingredients.
So when some argue, as people argued at the town meetings, which I'm sure you heard, mm-hmm. that we don't even know what's in the feed, that these are secrets that Purdue is holding back from the world.
They said Purdue.
I think someone said Purdue, if I remember correctly, I'll have to double check. From a two grower, I think.
And I guess the feed ticket. I would have said. I mean, the next question would be: so, what about what you get on the feed ticket?
Right. And I continue an example of feed ticket if you'd like to see.
No, I mean, that was. So that's a category. I mean, category saying no. That what is in our feed, produced food, is not a secret.
Right. The exact recipe is just like Mrs. Field's cookies recipe is, but the ingredients are not.
Later that day, we went to a farm of one of Purdue's contractors near Laurel, Delaware, and Mike Levengood showed us one of the feed tickets by the chicken houses we were touring.
You know, this is a typical feed ticket, and on there it's showing what's in there, like the ingredients, protein, fat, fiber. There's the active drug ingredient, naricin, nicarbicin.
When we were talking earlier, this back at the office, that's not what you mean by ingredients.
Yeah.
Is this what you mean by ingredients?
Yeah, protein, fat, and fiber's in there. And then this is the active drug ingredient is naricin, nicarbicin.
The reason that we don't, Purdue or any company doesn't list, is it fiber, fat, protein, what that's made of is because.
Okay, so you're asking why that's not specifically listed?
Yeah.
I'm assuming
great,
the format's dictated.
Out of a lot of things, you know. I mean, but, you know.
And people spend a lot of time and energy kind of deciding the best way to do that. So there's some proprietary pieces of that, you know.
So we wrap up our show today, still uncertain of the ingredients in produced chicken feed, but we'll be continuing our discussions with them in upcoming episodes of Soundbites on Delmarva. And thanks to all of our guests, Steve Schwalb, Vice President of Environmental Sustainability, Dr. Bruce Stewart Brown, Senior Vice President of Food Safety and Quality, Mike Levengood, Vice President of Live Production, and Julie DeYoung, a Purdue spokesman, and the Purdue Company for allowing us to come in and spend time with them. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll join us again here next week. Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. For complete podcasts of our past episodes and information on how to contact us with your feedback and ideas for upcoming shows, please go to our website, www.ondelmarva.org. And for Public Radio Delmarva, I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Take care.